shout out to the teachers. If we have any educators that are listening, shout out to you.
Absolutely.
Because I think we all have those teachers who made a profound impact on the way that we thought about ourselves and our abilities. And I kind of think that's the point of today's episode. If you're a person who hasn't found that person yet, keep looking. And even if you are a person who has like really fond memories of like your third grade teacher or your sixth grade teacher, still keep looking.
Yeah.
Because there aren't many feelings that are worth chasing. But I'd argue that that feeling of when you find a great teacher, that's one of the feelings that's worth chasing forever, because they're often in places that you wouldn't expect. Welcome to the Rich and Regular podcast presented by Success, where we explore life at the intersection of money. I'm Kirsten.
And I'm Julian. Today we're talking about our favorite ways to learn about money.
Yes, let's argue.
I didn't say that.
You know, this is one of those rare topics where Julian and I don't see eye to eye. It's not that we don't agree. It's just that we have very different learning styles, and mine is obviously the better one.
Yeah, that is not true. But yeah, you're all about taking courses and yes. going to conferences.
Come
and
on.
Buying structure. 20 books at yes. a time. And I'm like much more of a dive in, and let's just get into it, and we will learn on the go. Yeah. I wasn't always like that, though. Like when I was younger and definitely in my 20s, I did all those things that you did. But, you know, when I look back on what was most memorable for me and what really led to the best results, I've become much more in favor of just diving in on the deep end and learning as I go.
Yeah, I'm getting there. I'm becoming a convert, but, you know, I don't like to admit it. But in all seriousness, you know, one of the best things about the internet is how accommodating it is for all kinds of different learning styles. And so you really don't have to pick one. You can just kind of dabble in all of them and surf your mood and pick the one that best fits whatever you're learning or however you feel that day.
Yep, that's key.
You know, when you think about how information used to be traditionally distributed, like in classrooms, it was really limited and kind of excluded a lot of folks from benefiting. You know, I'm someone who has a strong appreciation for structure, and so I happen to do well in traditional classroom settings. I kind of understood what was happening. You know, the teacher teaches, I memorize it, I take a test, and then I get a grade that determines, you know, what colleges I go into, what scholarships I qualify. It was very cause and effect for me, and so I was able to do it pretty easily. But unfortunately, the real world just is not like that. And, you know, as more data comes out, we can see that the causes and effects of a classroom vary drastically based on zip code, school district, and your home environment, your teachers, all kinds of stuff. You know, would you say you were a good student? You know, how did your experience in classrooms kind of develop your learning style?
Yeah, so I was a pretty good student. I can remember even in my younger days as a boy, you know, and even going through high school and college, I was pretty much straight A's and B's. I think when I was older, I realized that if I didn't have to work, I would probably get all A's. But, you know, at the same time, I don't know that I would change a thing, because work gave me a place to learn and argue and debate some of the things that I was already learning, which sort of led to unlocking some other pretty important skills. And in the process of talking with other adults, especially and people who didn't go to my school or weren't in my class, I had a chance to talk about what I learned in a way that felt natural. And I realized very quickly that that was part of the learning process, like defending your point of view or justifying a certain claim that you're making. And if you don't really have real world experience to justify it, you really just kind of sound like you're quoting a book or something else that someone else said. Exactly. And I realized that that didn't really, you know, help. The other thing I would say is having great teachers is also something that I think most people can say was like a really important part of the learning experience, assuming we're talking about your typical classroom style. Like having a great teacher is like the secret sauce that helps make that lesson stick.
Yes. Shout out to the teachers. If we have any educators that are listening, shout out to you.
Absolutely.
Because I think we all have those teachers who made a profound impact on the way that we thought about ourselves and our abilities. And I kind of think that's the point of today's episode. If you're a person who hasn't found that person yet, keep looking. And even if you are a person who has like really fond memories of like your third grade teacher or your sixth grade teacher, still keep looking.
Yeah.
Because there aren't many feelings that are worth chasing. But I'd argue that that feeling of when you find a great teacher, that's one of the feelings that's worth chasing forever, because they're often in places that you wouldn't expect.
No, I completely agree with that. And even as you're talking, it's like making me think about some of my favorite teachers. I remember them vividly, like I would imagine most people do. And honestly, they change your life.
Yeah. So maybe we start, because we're on a good note with teachers. Maybe we start with the learning style that we both agree on.
Okay.
We both love learning from stories.
Yes.
Yes. I remember when we first started dating, I was still reading like all these nonfiction business books to learn about leadership and innovation to prepare for this new position that we were taking on at the company. And Julian was reading autobiographies.
Oh, yeah.
Like, I would offer up some framework about how to think about interdepartmental conflict. And he would cite a lesson from, I don't know, like Nelson Mandela's Long Walk to Freedom.
Yeah. I would look at all those books and just, they were coasters. and again, it's not to disrespect the authors or the subject matter, but I was just at a certain point in my life. And I think particularly after having gone through graduate school, and it's not to, you know, play the typical, oh, well, I went to grad school card. It wasn't about that. But that's all you do in grad school is burn through these books, burn through these frameworks, burn through these case studies. So the last thing you want to do when you are into the real world is try to replicate that process. It's
right.
about really getting in there. And you really find that a lot of the really great nuggets come from other people who have done amazing things. And even till this day, as much as I love the journey of entrepreneurship that we're on, I don't really read that many books from other entrepreneurs. To your point, I read and gain wisdom about leadership from people who are outside of business. And I actually find them to be much more applicable to the parts of this journey that matter the most to me. But to your point, Nelson Mandela's Long Walk to Freedom, I highly recommend it. I remember reading that for the second or third time, like on our honeymoon, because we were in South Africa, so it felt a little appropriate. But it was a great book. It's still a great book, and I will probably reread it again. One of the things that I learned is I was trying to share lessons very early on about money with people that I really felt that they could benefit from was that what motivated them to take action was different for different people. And it goes back to everyone having different learning styles. At the time, I was still very much accustomed to that standard way of learning about money and lecture style, classroom style. And so I would go to, let's say, a barbershop or be sitting around with friends at a cookout or something like that. And I'd find myself replicating these factoids. And it would just sort of fall on deaf ears. And it really took me a while to realize that actually, one, that doesn't resonate with everyone. Mm-hmm. You've got to figure out another way to create that breakthrough. And that's in part what motivated us to create and produce this video series that we do called Money on the Table. We launched this in 2020, but in fairness, the idea was brewing as early as like 2017, and we didn't really launch it or put any money to actually create it until 2020, while we were really like in the middle or in the beginning stages of the pandemic. If you've not seen it, go to our website, go to our YouTube page or any of our social media platforms and you'll see it. But basically, it's where we blend our love for talking about money and learning about money with our other love, which is food. Going back to the feeling of some of these messages falling on deaf ears, we realized that part of the reason why people weren't interested in learning about personal finance is because it was boring and it was just dull and people couldn't relate to it. And so we said, all right, but what do people like to watch? And a lot of people like watching food and cooking. Mm-hmm. And so, all right, well, how do we blend the two and then use that as a bit of a door to introduce this type of content to people who otherwise would not find learning about money interesting? And it allowed people to really just be a fly on the wall. Mm-hmm. I would cook a meal, or in the case of season two, we'll go to a restaurant and meet and have a conversation about a financial topic or a series of financial topics with other people, and other people just kind of get to watch. And it's really, really interesting. It's fun to do. But I think what's most important is that it's not necessarily educational. It's more insightful.
Yes.
Yeah. It's not forcing this lesson and saying, today we're going to talk about how to blah, blah, blah. It's more like, this is how these people think about money. you can agree or disagree, but it helps to start a conversation. And we found that to be very, very impactful.
Yeah. Like I've loved the thing that I loved about season two the most was just listening to other people's stories. And you can tell from the comments that we get and the emails that we get that stories have a way of cutting through in a way that stats don't, you know? Producing Money on the Table for me has started to show me why people are crazy enough to get into filmmaking, because outside of like starting a church, it's hard for me to come up with another way that influences people at scale. Like we talk about college all the time and we talk about, you know, these institutions as ways to like change your mind and expand your mindset. But I don't think there's a tool that's done it as effectively and efficiently as movies, you know?
No, you're absolutely right. It's making me think about the movie that we were in. And I remember having a conversation very early on with the director, Travis Shakespeare, who, fun fact, is related to William Shakespeare.
Oh, nice.
But he's the director of Playing with Fire, which is a movie about the fire movement that we were really fortunate to be a part of that was released a few years ago. And he was talking to me about stories as he was thinking about who he was going to bring into the film and what he really wanted to highlight. And he was always asking, what's the story? What's the story? Because again, this is someone who's one, passionate about this movement, but also understood that if you want to reach people at scale, you have to find a relatable story, something that they can connect with and use that as a mechanism to help create change. And that's what he tried to do. And I thought he did an excellent job. To your point, that's what we are trying to do and recreate in our own little way with our video series and in part with this podcast, our blog, and just about everything that we do. It's less about forcing facts and analyzing things that have already been analyzed. It's about how do we find and continue to tell stories that resonate with people? I'm sure Kendra, who is the chief storytelling officer for Success, agrees with the power of storytelling and this idea. She's literally written the book about it and several books probably. Yeah, it's another reason why we launched Money on the Table, because we realized that, to her point and lots of other people's point, that it is an incredibly powerful way to help make messages stick, especially if you can accompany that with really compelling visuals.
Yes.
This is really making me think about when we first decided to self-manage our money instead of using a financial advisor, and how you ended your policies with an insurer. Because just going through the emotions of that process and sharing that story with other people helped them realize that they actually felt the exact same way that we did. They were confused about whether or not they were making the right decision. They kind of felt, dare I say, sold on some of these policies, even though they didn't really understand it, but they were just doing it anyway.
Because, and they didn't understand the alternatives.
Exactly. And they'd also not seen examples of people who decided to say, you know what, this isn't working for me. This isn't what I want. I don't feel good about this, or I don't feel that I need this. And that was enough for them to reconsider or reevaluate what they were doing. And I think that's another great example of the power of storytelling. Because we were willing to share our vulnerability, others saw themselves in that. They were able to relate to that feeling because they had similar anxieties, and it was enough to move them to action.
Yes. So I think the takeaway here is that every subject, regardless of whether we're talking about love or if we're talking about money, is connected to a story. So if you can tap into your own story, you have a better chance of connecting to why you may or may not be hitting your goals. And if you can tap into other people's stories, then you also have like this built-in support system to help you, you know, cross over different hurdles and eventually accomplish your goals. So we both agree that we love learning from stories. One area that you're actually more natural at pursuing is being a hands-on learner. I didn't appreciate the value of hands-on learning until I actually started working full-time. I was one of those people that thought that learning could replace practice. And so in my first job, which was at a big box retail store, I was leading teams of like 15 or 20 people right after I graduated college. I had no idea what I was doing, but I did what every good management trainee would do and read management books. I would try to learn how to be a good manager by reading about performance conversations, but little did I actually know that having a performance conversation is very different from studying one. So what I've had to learn the hard way is that learning and practice actually work best when they're done together. They're not these two things that are at odds. And my studying, my learning, my reading can actually help me plan and edit and coach myself while I practice, but it doesn't actually replace practicing.
Yeah, I'm happy to hear you say that. There are a lot of parallels, in my opinion, with how people learn about leadership and how people learn about money. You could argue I was in the same boat. I was learning about leadership from world leaders and listening and tapping into their own stories. I found that to be valuable. But if I were to bring that to the workplace,
yeah. It didn't necessarily... like, you're not Mandela. Yeah, shut up.
Exactly. So it didn't always work out. But these are the things that you learn. What I have learned, though, is that there are an entirely different set of lessons that are only unlocked after you apply what you've already learned. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I can't think of one big thing I've ever learned that was just as it said in the book.
Right.
Right. It just doesn't work that way.
And now that we've written a book, I understand why that's the case, is because, you know, your editors kind of strip out all the nuance that may confuse your reader, and the lessons are often confusing.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, something is always inevitably different, and you don't get to learn that thing until you apply what you already know. And obviously, the same is true for money and investing. This is making me think of, I won't say his name, but the guy who has helped us move pretty much mm-hmm. every single time for the last few years. The last time he helped me move, actually, he wasn't helping me move. He was helping my mother move. He finally built up the courage, and we were having a conversation about money. I've known him, just for the record, a little bit of context, I've known him for 20 years at this point. This is the first time we actually ended up having a conversation about money, because he was seeing some of the things that we were doing online and, you know, took up some courage to say, hey, man, what are some of these things that I'm seeing? And so we started explaining it, and we were specifically talking about investing, and he wanted me to explain why I was so bullish and why I was such a big fan of index funds. And then finally he said, all right, I'm going to do it. I'm going to, you know, open up this account. I'm going to invest in my first index fund. And the very next day, he texted me. He was like, hey, man, it's asking me this thing and that thing. You know what mm-hmm. I mean? And I realized that, oh, I actually didn't get into that question. He was specifically asking me about the ask price versus the bid price. And I was basically telling him the difference. But again, you don't learn everything at first.
Right.
You learn enough to get started, and then you really have to be confident that you know enough to continue to do it. Now, in this case, he was actually dissuaded and discouraged, and mm-hmm. so he ended up kicking the can down the road, because I think it just made him feel a little insecure. He really just wanted it to be just as simple as I told him it was, and I don't know that that would have been any different if he'd read our book or not. And mm-hmm. so all that to say, this is just a part of the process when you're right. learning. You're learning, but it doesn't mean that you know everything just because you've completed the curriculum. Learning is enough to get you through the door to unlock the next set of lessons that really only come after you've applied what you already understand to be true.
Yes. Now I want to go back to books, because okay. I love books.
You do.
I've been reading since I was 3, and all these years later, my version of a good day still usually includes a book. And books are, you know, one of my favorite forms of learning, and they were actually the first way that I started learning about money. So although you don't learn everything from a book, it can be the catalyst for, you know, you starting to learn about money, or, you know, pursue some different avenue of financial literacy.
Yep.
Now, what has changed over the years has been how I read. So I actually got this paradox from Toni Morrison, who likes to differentiate reading as a skill from reading as an art.
Okay.
And I would say that most of the reading that I had done in my life, particularly about money, has been about reading as a skill. So this is like practicing critical thinking, learning how to understand financial terminology, things like that. But lately, I've been practicing reading as an art, which she says is really about listening. And there's a different set of financial lessons that you get when you're reading as an art. So as a content creator, learning how to read in that way has not only improved my writing, which hopefully you all will see in our upcoming book, plug here, but it's also helped me improve my storytelling. As a student, though, when I'm reading other people's money stories or finance blogs, I've started to read it as an art more so than as a skill. And it's helped me to go deeper into their content, ask better questions, and goes back to what you were saying, be able to explain where I stand on an issue. And we can disagree amicably. Like, I don't have to agree with everything that I read anymore. And I don't have to make it a crisis that someone might disagree with me, or that I might have a differing opinion on something. Like, I am literally just reading as an art and listening to, you know, their own experience and hopefully getting a different lesson from it.
Yeah. And this is where I completely disagree, at least in my scenario. And part of the reason why is because I'm not going to say I have a photographic memory, but I do have a very absorbent mind. And part of the reason why I don't read and haven't been reading nearly as much in the last 2 years as we've been writing this book is because I realized that the more that I read, the more I start to incorporate other people's voices mm-hmm. into my own. And I don't want to sound like a derivative of anyone else. I want to have my own voice. I don't, you know, no disrespect to Toni Morrison or any of the other wonderful, amazing writers out there. But I find that if I listen to them too much, I basically start to just sound like them. I'm an echo, right, as opposed to just being my own original voice and having my own original point of view, or even just explaining my own experience without the context that is reliant on someone else's version.
Yeah, the meaning
version.
That they gave the same experience.
Correct, correct. Yeah. I don't even have to use that metaphor because it literally does not, you know, resonate with my own lived experience. Now, mm-hmm. again, that's not to say that I don't like books, but I don't read nearly as much as I used to, and that's in part because we've been doing a lot of writing on our own. I have, though, watched quite a bit of film, and what I've really, really come to appreciate are interviews and even things like mm-hmm. podcasts or just listening to people, because what I'm paying attention to now is tone and tonality in the other person. Because that, to me, is where I can really sense how they really feel about whatever it is that they're talking about. Mm-hmm. And for me, you don't really get that with a book. Now, you might say, well, that's what audiobooks are for. But as someone who's yeah. getting ready to record an audiobook, that's still very
much...
It's still
a controlled environment.
It's a controlled environment. It's a performance, in a mm-hmm. way, as opposed to when I'm learning about someone who is just having a natural conversation. You can really see what they're passionate about or what they're dismissive about. And that, to me, is part of the learning and something that I'm much more paying attention to these days. This is also making me think about one of our friends, Diana, who co-hosts the Optimal Living Daily podcast, in addition to leading an amazing conference that we'll be attending in November called the Economy Conference. Mm-hmm. Kirsten's going to be speaking at that conference, but she's done something really, really cool with that podcast because she's basically identifying and curating some of her favorite blog posts about money and then recording them. So mm-hmm. what you're actually listening to is her rendition or interpretation, or in some cases, just a flat out script of someone else's blog post, which I think is really, really interesting.
Yeah.
Because you get to hear someone else's interpretation of your own words.
Yeah, it's interesting where she puts emphasis and
yeah.
how, whether, you know, parts that are supposed to be funny actually come off as funny because somebody else is reading it.
Right.
It's a really, I obviously have a different experience as a writer being read, but it's a really, one, great way to get financial information every single day. It's a daily podcast. But two, just really interesting, to your point, to see how people interpret words differently.
And it gives that blogger or writer an opportunity to reach people if they don't yeah. have a podcast. It goes back to how people prefer to learn about money. And so if you're a podcaster, but you don't read blogs, you kind of get to listen right. to a podcast about a blogger.
Yes. This is a perfect segue because I am 100% a graduate of YouTube University.
You are.
I have whatever honors come on YouTube University, magna cum laude, whatever. Thank you, laude, as my mama says. But I love videos as a way to learn, and it's actually become my default start for searches. So sometimes I'll start in Google, but almost inevitably I click the videos tab to see if there's someone that can just talk me through it rather than having to skim it. So I might be using YouTube more for audio than for visual. And it reminds me of this other article that I was reading last year about Spotify that was written by their founder and CEO after he announced their ambition to be audio first.
Okay.
So very similar to how people think about YouTube as the go-to site for video content, Spotify wants to be the go-to platform for audio and not just for music. So they've been investing heavily in podcasts and other original programming. So anyway, this article that the CEO of Spotify wrote cites that consumers spend roughly the same amount of time on video as they do on audio, but that video is a $1 trillion market, and the music and radio industry is only worth about $100 billion.
Only.
Yeah, big numbers. But the CEO asked this question, are our eyes worth 10 times more than our ears? And I thought that was such a brilliant question for a CEO. He obviously doesn't think that's the case, or he wouldn't be investing in our ears. But he just talks about podcasting as a means to create deep engagement and value in new ways, especially now that the world is focused on limiting screen time and recognizes that, like, staring at your phone all day isn't a great use of time. But I always go back to the article because it's a reminder of, one, how new podcasting still is, and two, how much potential the format still has to change the way that people learn, because you can do it from almost anywhere. So I was just curious, like, do you still listen to podcasts now that you don't have a commute? You know, I still do, but I'm curious if you still find ways to listen to podcasts, and, are you listening to learn from them, or are you listening just to be entertained?
So no, I do not listen to podcasts nearly as much as I used to. I mean, I primarily used to listen to them on my commute, and now that we don't have one, there's that. Now, that's really no excuse, because I do a good bit of cycling these days, and those are opportunities for me to just sort of zone out. But I'm much more likely to listen to music than a podcast while I am
keeps your pace a little better.
Yeah, but I will say, when I go to the gym and I'm on a treadmill, I've tried it a couple times with a podcast, and that's actually a really interesting experience. Mm-hmm. But again, it's not nearly as motivating as, like, if I have like a up tempo heavy bass song. But I used to listen to, and we mentioned this in our last podcast, but Hidden Brain, because again, I'm much more interested into the psychology and the way that the brain works and how that has an impact on how people think about money. Planet Money, obviously, I have a clear bias to NPR. Planet Money is one of my favorite podcasts. Yep. And then TED Talks, which is also from NPR. So just about everything and anything NPR is really, really cool for me.
Nerd.
No, I'll take it. But those are a few of my favorites. Obviously, there are others, but those are some of the big ones that I would listen to. But even as you're talking about TED Talks, you know, oftentimes I might have been introduced to a particular TED Talk by watching the actual video. Mm. And then what I would do was watch an interpretation of that TED Talk. And in some cases, you can listen to the speaker give a reaction or add some additional context to whatever it was that they were discussing in their TED Talk. And then you would have the interviewer asking them a little bit more probing questions around what they meant by that or what inspired something that they said. So it's all sort of connected for me. But I think what it sounds like, even as I'm kind of thinking about what my own preference has evolved into, is storytelling is much more impactful for me. And I think that's largely because I'm coming into my own as a storyteller, because I realize that it's actually really, really effective at helping people to, one, be inspired, but two, to take action and think differently about money.
Yes. So here's another differentiator. Do you know what one of my favorite financial topics is to learn from podcasts?
No.
Scams.
Interesting.
Yes.
I love scams.
Scammer podcasts, I got to tell you, are some of my favorites. They cover everything from corporate fraud to pyramid schemes. And then when you bring in like the sound effects and the interviews, it just makes the audio experience almost as good as visual.
Hmm.
So if anyone out there is looking for a recommendation, The Scam Goddess is a good one, and so is The Dream. And then for the real estate lovers out there, there's a long form one called California City, and it's about how thousands of people got scammed into buying this useless land out in California like several years ago.
I love it already because, again, those are the things that make people understand like the tone of a scammer.
Yes.
So that when you hear that frequency or you hear that language or that word choice, I can tell you all day, and I think we even said it in one of our previous podcasts, anyone that tells you guaranteed returns, if you hear it coming from me, you're going to say, got it. Don't listen to anyone that says guaranteed returns. But then when you listen to some scammy dude or someone,
and you listen to the interviews of the victims
reenacting this experience and what it felt like to actually hear it, that is more like likely going to be the thing that says, oh my gosh, that sounds like the guy that I go to the gym with. Mm-hmm. Or that sounds like the guy that I go to church with. Yikes. Or that sounds like, you know,
yeah.
And that's really, really cool.
All right, let's take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll talk about a few other ways to learn about money. All right, welcome back. I'm not sure if you remember this, but way back when this was like a newborn podcast, we're still like a baby podcast, but back when we were like fresh out of the podcast womb, we did an episode on financial literacy. It was episode number 3 called Financial Literacy and Overcoming Hesitance. Anyway, I mentioned that our impulse to keep being educated comes from this idea that somebody else is better suited to solve our financial problems than we are.
Okay.
And at the very end of the episode, you offer a valid counterpoint about role models and community being really important. So I wanted to bring that back because it might have gotten lost in that baby episode. But what role do you think role models play in how we learn about money, both good and bad?
Yeah, so that is a really, really recent, I don't want to say phenomenon, but something that I've realized. And obviously it's been there all along, but it's something that I've really come to appreciate. So a couple of things, going back to Money on the Table, because one of, I think, the most beautiful and impactful episodes that we shot of that series was in part about the importance of role models. And again, this comes from someone, and by someone I mean myself, who has devoted their life to trying to inspire others to make better financial decisions or to think differently about money and to inspire better, more nuanced conversations about money in the world today. And what I learned over the years is what works and what doesn't, at least for me and the people that I'm communicating with. And what I've learned over the years is just how critically important role models are in helping people overcome some of their biases and think differently about money, but ultimately about taking actions. They are the key. Like, I know we talk about community, but sometimes your role models are part of that community as well. And so the two are, in essence, connected, but they make the unlearned feel relevant.
Yeah.
And what I mean by that is if you've learned something and you haven't applied it yet, you can kind of learn in part through a role model, assuming you have one and you identify with them. They can make it feel real. And that's what makes it so much easier for you to overcome that hesitation or to dismiss the validity of a particular investment or just the act of saving or, you know, whatever it is. Like, that is just such an important thing. It makes the impossible impossible. Or role models sort of make those dreams feel like attainable. And it's really, really interesting. But in that episode, we basically brought together two sets of role models. As a married couple, we brought together one set, which is Rob and Rishon. They live in Dallas-Fort Worth, but they basically are full-time world travelers at this point. They're early, what do they call it? Baby, what do you call them?
Empty nesters.
Rob and Rishon are empty nesters. They are young. They're beautiful. They're having fun. They're living their lives. And in part, we learn from them because it gives us an idea of what life may look like when our son is out of the house. And then we brought together Lynette and Earl, and they are even further along. And then we can look at them and say, wow, this is what life might look like, you know, and when we're in our 50s or something. And it's just incredible to see them. And it just makes early retirement or being a seven-figure entrepreneur and or just, you know, a happy, you know, on vacation married couple.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, it makes all of those things seem really, really real. So if you don't get it, if you haven't seen it, I highly recommend watching that episode. It's about role models and estate planning, but it's a great example that I think helps to highlight the importance of role models and the role it plays, not even just in money, but in life, in marriage, in careers, in just about everything you can think of.
It actually reminds me of a conversation we had in Money on the Table season 1, where you said something along the lines of your earliest financial lessons are learned and not taught.
Yes.
And I'm always repeating that to myself, learned and not taught, because it opens my mind to the fact that my brain is a sponge, whether or not I'm sitting in a classroom and intending to be taught. It is learning just based off of what's happening in the world, what kind of reactions I feel, what scares me, what brings me joy, what brings me excitement. And so it's constantly learning. And the more that you can visualize and normalize people making bold, long-term decisions with their money, the less scary it starts to feel, which again, just speaks to the importance of surrounding yourself and actively seeking out different teachers, different role models, and different communities.
Love it. Okay, let's wrap this one up. What are your final thoughts?
My final thought is really a suggestion, which is to have fun with it. I think part of the reason people feel stuck or like they can't learn anything new is because they're still using these stale definitions of how learning takes place. The reality is a lot of our entertainment can be educational, and it's just learning in a different outfit. And you don't need to draw a line between your learning and your playing. You can just use your imagination and look for lessons everywhere.
I love that. And, you know, I don't know that my final thoughts are that similar, but I will add that there are no right or wrong ways to learn about money. To your point about what I said last year, the first book, podcast, or video that you watch is like about money or an subject is likely not going to be the very first time you've learned about that thing. So you're going to have to do a little bit of unlearning, but that's okay. Whether it's a video or a seminar or a conference or a webinar, they're all fantastic. Try to dabble a little bit, see which ones work. And by work, I mean which ones lead you to action mm-hmm. and which ones feel best. At the end of the day, your personal financial journey is yours. And so you need to be able to try and dabble and taste and figure out which one of those platforms or approaches work best for you. And that, more often than not, is going to be what you probably need to stick with.
Yes. Well, thank you for listening to another episode of the Rich and Regular podcast presented by Success. We'd love to learn what you thought about this episode. If you like what you heard, please leave us a 5-star rating and review. We will see you next week.